But I want to say, for the benefit of people among us who come from America, this is not a jibe at your nation or your people. And I'm aware, as others here might be aware, of how Americans now in Europe, seeing their country from the outside, begin to take a different relationship to it. 3 weeks ago, I was preaching in the English Reformed Church in Amsterdam, and after the service, I met an elderly couple, they'd be in their 70s, who came from Albany, New York, and I just happened to say at the door that I'd be passing through Albany in September when I go to Vermont. And I discovered later that this couple had gone for coffee into the church hall and sat next to a friend of mine who's a great conversationalist, but she could not get a word in edgeways because for 10 minutes, this elderly, previously Republican-voting couple did nothing but apologize for what their country and particularly their president was doing to the world, and then said that they had heard that the preacher was going to be in Albany in September, and if he wanted to stay at their home for free for a week or more, then their doors were open. This is almost an embarrassed kind of atonement. I would hope that any here from America who are among us might see what I say not as an onslaught in their country, but rather as that which all of us are helped by when we go to another culture or another nation and we get a perspective on our own land which is not made available to us when we live there. I want to outline two or three captivities which I believe we're being led back to, albeit in the name of progress. And they are captivities or Egypts which I believe we have to question in the light of and for the credibility of the gospel. And they have to do with a return to the Cold War mentality in which the world was divided into goodies and baddies, when competing forces defended their ideologies and attacked the ideologies of others through conflicts waged always on foreign shores, and where policies of cultural and political isolation were espoused. Now, the first is to do with the goodies and baddies. It's a demonization thing, which we in this country took part in the past. Britain was engaged in this during World War II, and thereafter, after the defeat of Nazism, there was a continuing demonization of Germans and Japanese in the popular media and in children's comics well up until the 1960s. Virtue was always on the side of the British, vice on the side of others. I remember seeing this in stark relief when I visited, as a young student, a woman in the congregation I was working in Kilmarnock. And on top of this woman's television, there was a photograph of a young man in RAF uniform. Now, this woman was a particularly melancholic type. And on one occasion, to try to boost the conversation, I said to her, "Mrs. Stewart, whose picture is that?" And suddenly her face grimaced and her voice became very angry and bitter. And she said, "That's Jimmy. The Germans got him over Dresden." Now, I wanted to ask her whether he was over Dresden on some kind of pleasure flight, but I didn't think that would help Mrs. Stewart nor my relationship with her. We who expatriated and starved the Irish during the potato famine, we who introduced concentration camps to the world in the Boer War, we who pioneered the aerial bombing of civilian populations came out of the war with clean hands somehow. Both America and Britain joined forces to demonize the Soviet Union in the wake of World War II. It had been our ally against the Nazis, but with the partitioning of Europe, it became the enemy. Our long-range nuclear weapons were firmly focused on Moscow. It was named the evil empire by Ronald Reagan, who had never been there. And only when Gorbachev began to consort with Thatcher did suspicion begin to drop. And when the curtain fell, what was the demonic truth behind it? We discovered, as I discovered last year in the Czech Republic and this year in Romania, that there was a crumbling economic system, a dispirited league of Eastern nations, each with its own internal disorder, a bear which didn't have much by the way of claws. Well, now the Japs and the Krauts and the Russians have found new surrogates in the predominantly Islamic axis of evil. The term was coined and the name was called before battle was engaged. It came in league with a slip of the tongue about the need for a crusade by the coalition of the willing. And Christians cannot assent to this. not because we meekly must turn the other cheek when somebody slaps our national faith, but because the sin most frequently inveighed against in Scripture is slander. Malicious gossip and the perpetration of misinformation is not simply an insult to the truth, it's a reflection on the person who is spreading the gossip. Here are some of the promulgated myths by which we and North America, the USA that's to say, demonise the so-called enemy. The enemy, be that Russia or North Korea or the Middle East, is often portrayed as dictatorial and undemocratic. Well, who in Britain authorised our leaders to invade Iraq? And apart from the fact that fewer people vote in the USA than vote in the Eastern nations percentage-wise, didn't that business with the Chads in Florida call into question democratic representative government? The enemy is presented sometimes as a threat to national security. This was said of Nicaragua, a country with almost 3% of the population of the states and an economy in ruins. It's also still said of Cuba, it's a threat to national security. Though what threat Cuba now poses, I cannot understand, unless it is the fact that universal health care in Cuba throws into stark profile the lack of even basic provisions such as prenatal care in states such as Louisiana. On the other hand, what could be a bigger threat to national security than to have the sole superpower in the world arming the very reactionary forces, as in Nicaragua, which the people had voted out? Or, as in the case of Chile, on September the 11th, 1973, in helping to depose President Salvador Allende, who had won the popular vote. The enemy is accused of inhumane treatment of its civilian population. And undoubtedly, in Stalin's Russia and in Hussein's Iraq, this was true. But why does America have over 2 million of its citizens behind bars? And why is Britain on a jail-building spree, especially when it has been admitted that over half the people in prison are not there because of ingrained criminal intent, but because of offences linked to drugs and to drink? And why is it that in the state of Texas, you are not allowed to qualify for welfare unless you have a car? Unless you don't have a car. The very state in which there is no public transport and you need a car to get anywhere. And why did we call Northern Ireland its conflict the Troubles when every other country under the world could see and could call it a civil war? So there's a demonisation which is characteristic of the Cold War, and that's what we are being seduced back into doing, demonise the alleged enemy. And the second Egypt into which we are being seduced is to fight again surrogate battles. Since the end of World War II, there is the rumour that peace has reigned. True in respect of the fact that until the recent conflagration in Iraq, there has been no multinational and international sustained act of aggression. Though it might be noted that since 1945, the USA has bombed 20 different countries, at least one in every continent. But as long as the Cold War reigned, there was a succession of regional skirmishes, many wars, in which the major opponents, the Soviet Union and the USA, fought each other through or by proxy of their political and financial dependence. The Cuba crisis in the 60s was one such adventure when Khrushchev tried to put nuclear weapons on an offshore island which America had once ruled until people claimed back their autonomy. The Korean and the Vietnam Wars were conflicts on foreign soil in which the West and the East in the Northern Hemisphere took pot shots at each other through their South Asian surrogates. The Afghan War was financed by the USA in order, among other things, to be a drain on the Soviet Union's finances. It was happening at the same time as Reagan launched his Star Wars initiative, another expensive diversion meant to milk dry the Soviet economy. The Iran War was a similar surrogate conflict this time with Saddam Hussein acting in the USA's best interests. The sad thing now is that with the exception of sporadic financing from wealthy individuals and the occasional government agency in the Middle East, the present conflicts in the world are ones in which the world's only superpower and its best friend are visibly one-sided in their engagement. No nation is financing al-Qaeda. But Iraq is the killing ground, and the Iraqis are the disposable population through which the USA uses battlefield tactics to combat urban guerrillas. There have been fewer than 1,000 coalition service personnel killed in Iraq to date, but there almost have been 12,000 Iraqi civilians. Russia and China are not financing Palestine. But the largest proportion of American foreign aid goes to enable Israel to be armed up to the teeth in order to keep a friendly client state in the Middle East. And even where no conflict exists, British and American arms manufacturers supply sometimes the same, sometimes opposing forces, as in the subcontinent of India or in Indonesia, because war, even the wars we don't personally fight, war is good for business. And Christians cannot condone this, not because we are afraid to deal with thorny international conflicts. The Mennonite tradition in America, one of the historic peace churches, is always involved in reconciliation in the thorniest of conflicts, which includes Northern Ireland. But we cannot condone this because we cannot be both a peacemaker and an engager in conflict, and it's to peacemaking that we are called. How can the USA expect itself to be believed to be an honest broker between Israel and Palestine when it has publicly funded the one and publicly demonized the other? The same was true previously of our tactics in Northern Ireland. Why should the Republicans trust the alleged peacekeeping exploits of the Westminster government when it singularly refused to do anything to depoliticise the policing of the province or confront the sectarian way in which employment was offered or withheld, sometimes on the basis of the name of your primary school? The third aspect of the Cold War, the third Egypt to which we are being seduced back, has to do with isolationism. Not so much the isolating of the enemy as the withdrawal from the community of nations of those who believe that they are the key players with righteousness on their side. Britain wants to be in Europe, but we also want to be out of Europe. The USA wanted to be in the United Nations and to call the tune, but not until after September the 11th did it begin to make back payment for its long-term unpaid dues to the United Nations. During the Cold War, both the Soviet Union and its satellite states had as little to do with the West as possible. Visas were refused, family reunions between East and West Germans were impossible, academic contact was limited. And are things much better today in the free West? Well, ask America or Americans when they last saw a French film. And if they didn't see one recently, why not? It's because there is a tariff barrier, a tax which has been erected to prevent French and other foreign language films coming into the States. You see, although you can see foreign language films in Holland and Romania, where I was 2 weeks ago, although you can see them in almost any European or Asian country, you cannot see foreign films so easily in the States. This tariff has been erected. And why is the tariff barrier there? Because the States is afraid of unfair competition with Hollywood. If the French film industry is partly subsidized by the French government, if the Chilean film industry, and there's a lovely film called Machuca, which is coming out in March, was premiered last week at the Edinburgh Film Festival. If the Chilean film industry is partly subsidised by the Chilean government. That is unfair competition to Hollywood, which is free and independent, although the recent fiasco over the distribution of Fahrenheit 9/11 puts paid to any notion of cinematographic neutrality. More pertinently, ask non-Americans who don't live in Europe, who live either in the Eastern Bloc or in Asia, ask them how easy it is to visit the country which boasts of its arms being open to all comers. Ask Carlos Campos, for example. He's 70 plus. He's a professor of theology in Cuba. He's an ordained minister and the secretary of the Cuban Presbyterian Church, which has grown in membership from 9 to 15,000 in the past 8 years. And all through the Cold War, there was the possibility of religious people, priests, ministers, professors of theology, going between Cuba and the United States, possibly because the USA felt that if Cubans could be converted to Christianity and away from communism, they would be much more pleasurable as near neighbours. For 30 years, Carlos has travelled without much difficulty from Cuba to the USA to meet friends, to give lectures, to go to conferences. But since Bush came in, that has become much more difficult, and he's now been waiting for a year and a half for a visa. Or ask Viola Arvuka from Poland. She's a teacher and lives with her husband in Warsaw. She kept contact with people who trained with her and who immigrated to America and lived in Boston. She had hoped this year to visit them. She had saved up enough money. She had all but purchased a return ticket. She had documents from the States indicating with whom she would live. She had documents proving that she had insurance to cover her stay. She had documents from Poland which indicated her relationship status, her job, and the fact that she would be returning. She filled in all the forms and made an appointment to visit the embassy. After 5 minutes of an interview, she was asked what her salary was. She told the official and was then informed that she would not be granted a visa. You'd think that a list of the criteria might have been sent out in advance, indicating that if your salary were below a certain level, you should go no further. What is much worse, and what few people know, is that in Poland you have to pay $100 for the privilege of the interview in which you will be refused. This is true also of Romania. Ask Ligia Monasteriano, who I met recently. It's true of the Philippines, where Francis Lucero. I'm speaking of real people, all of whom have money, all of whom have jobs, none of whom wanted to stay in the States, but wanted to go for a holiday or a conference. And they all had to pay $100 for an interview, after which they were refused. This national fetish for being isolationist and keeping others out is also seen in the reluctance of the president to sign agreements which are for the betterment of global relations, despite allegedly being keen to make the world a more peaceful place. So the Kyoto Accord is not signed. Why? Perhaps because it wasn't an American idea, and also because it would involve the citizenry of the USA taking on personal responsibility for the planet. The more recent failure to sign the pre-Olympic Games statement committing the world to be a peaceful place during the Games was not signed by the president. And more recently, as we've heard, there's been this kind of right-wing campaign by a group of Republicans who have set out to try to defame Kerry by having people who are not in authority pull the carpet out from him with regard to his record in Vietnam. And when asked whether he would join the voices of Republicans who wanted to apologise for this, the president said no. It would be such a relief if he'd only admit that he was dyslexic and that every time he went to write Bush, he wrote shrub instead. But more pertinently, for some people here, the isolationism has taken root in religious organisations, most notably at the Southern Baptists, who last month removed themselves from the World Baptist Federation, which is a significant move to poor Baptists, because The Southern Baptists represent a third of the membership and almost as much finance the World Federation. And why did they do this? Because, among other things, they felt that other Baptist churches in the world were being anti-American. Christians have to resist this kind of isolationism, not only because in national terms we bear witness to a God who loves the world and who has intentionally peopled it with different cultures and who wills, as we read in the prophets, that one day all nations will be gathered together before the throne of grace. Not only because in the history of the Jews, as at the exile, we recognize that sometimes God chooses to work through the enemy leader, and we cannot presume that God is always on our side. We have also to resist this trend of isolationism as the body of Christ, because we are called to be a joined-up community where no monopoly of gifts, spiritual or otherwise, is bestowed on one sector. Rather, the body only functions in the Pauline understanding of it when it is joined up and learns from and encourages interdependency. Well, so much for analysis, but we as Christians are not called to analyze the world. We are called to transform it by prayer and by action. I'm aware that in the majority of Americans who I've met, there is a sense of hopelessness, that politics is controlled from the top, that elections are won by funding, that whether in local or in national government, the people are not important. I'm astounded to talk with people who are the directors of publishing companies in the States and to find they would never be in touch with their local councillor because they do not believe that he or she would take note even of them. So I'm going to suggest five things, and these may be naive things. This is not a political blueprint because we are not met here as politicians. But five things about which you and I can pray, and five things which we might encourage our American colleagues to think of engaging in. And if one of them is not the removal of Bush from the White House, then that's because it can be taken as read. And I want to speak from the perspective of hope, not of optimism, because optimism is shallow, but hope is rooted in reality. And my hope began to be confirmed earlier on this year, when in Minneapolis, I went to see "This is the Dawning of the Age of Aquarius." Yeah, all aged hippies who are now blushing will remember here when it came to Britain. And in Minneapolis, they were showing here. Now, I remembered here because when I was about 19, it was a very daring thing. It came to the Glasgow Metropole. And I went with this girl who had a car up to Glasgow to watch it. And it had, as we were told in advance, a nude scene. As if we'd never seen members of the human body before. There was about 30 seconds in which the cast were naked on the stage. And in Glasgow, as elsewhere, it happens just before the interval. So they're singing something, "Let the sunshine, let the sunshine." They're taking off their clothes. And 30 seconds of nudity, and then the stage goes black. Well, in Glasgow, this, when the blackness came, so also came a blue flashing light and a police siren. And onto the stage, the Metropole, comes this big man, a policeman in Glasgow police uniform, and says, "Yous have been watching a pornographic performance. We do not have enough time or manpower to go through everyone here and to get their name and address, but we have taken the license plate numbers of the cars outside the theatre, and yous will be hearing from us soon." And I'm thinking, oh mercy, my girlfriend's parents, if she discovers that we've been at this. Well, it was an actor who was doing this, but we were fooled. At the end of the performance in Minneapolis, which had been totally 60s, I'd realised during it that it actually is a very political musical. It was a political musical against the Vietnam War. The hero is someone who wants to burn his draft card but doesn't do it, and he's sent to Vietnam and he dies. And it is a clearly anti-Vietnam message. Well, part of me was thinking, you know, there is no, at that time anyway, there was no popular cultural figure and no popular cultural movement which was offering alternative perspective to what America and Britain and others were doing in Iraq. At the end of the performance, the hero of the play, the guy who gets killed, after the applause, came to the front, and in a very unassuming, untheatrical, and quite emotionally charged voice, he said that the cast had decided that they would like to allow people who came to see the show to make a contribution as they left towards a charity. The charity was set up in memory of the first American female soldier who was killed in the conflict in Iraq. And all the money that was collected would go to an orphanage in Iraq for Iraqi children who had lost their parents during the conflict. The audience were as moved as the actor. It seemed as if for the first time they were empowered to enable things to be put right. So here are maybe five things to think of and to pray about and to encourage, and these are not sophisticated. The first is a better reading of the news. We have an intern, that's a person who comes in placement, an intern from the USA at the moment, a very intelligent and gifted young man who is worldly aware. He saw last Sunday the front pages of the Sunday Herald in my living room, which detailed the progress of the conflict in Iraq. And he said, you'd never see this kind of thing in the States, which is a truth, and it's well documented. The American press, in the main, does not deal with other parts of the world. And if it does, it's only to report American exports, American armed forces activity, or the visit of the American president. Between 1972 and 1977, less than one-tenth of a percent, 0.1% of all USA news in these 6 years involved Central America. This was the region which Reagan said stood at our doorstep. And 0.1% of all news in 6 years dealt with Central America. But 2 years later, either El Salvador or Nicaragua or Guatemala was headline news. Why? Because America had detected the creeping hand of communism and had sent military advisers to topple democratically elected governments. So civilians and church people, including the Southern Baptists who took up offerings in churches to enable the Contras to kill Christian presidents, most Americans met Central America not as a beautiful place, not as a place of diversity, but as a problem-ridden region which they had to solve. And this would be true for most places in the world as viewed from the perspective of the States. Despite the National Geographic Channel, knowledge of the rest of the world is incredibly limited. The first time I was in Texas, in San Antonio, a woman asked a friend of mine where he came from. He said, Canada. She said, what state's that in? He said, it's a very good state, ma'am. Newspapers, even if you can get them, and this year I spent a week in a university campus in Collegeville in Minnesota, a university campus in which there were conferences with adults going on for 3 months. There was not one newspaper on sale in the campus. But newspapers, even if you can get them, don't talk about the rest of the world. And if that's the case, then information has to come from other sources. That's why I regularly send my American colleagues news which I know they will not have. And that's why, biased as it undoubtedly is, Fahrenheit 9/11 is an important film. May Michael Moore live to make many more. Second thing is that we should encourage Americans, as we who are British should encourage ourselves, to become bilingual. Almost 20% of Americans are Spanish-speaking, and another 5% will be fluent in their mother tongue. Yet Spanish is not widely taught to non-Spanish speakers, and the assumption in schools is that the rest of the world should speak English. We're as bad as that in Britain as the Americans are. And I have to admit how convenient it is to discover that when you go abroad, English is the lingua franca. But as the Japanese theologian Koyosuke Koyama once said, the mother tongue God is too small. The mother tongue God is too small. And that theological insight is true for secular affairs as it is for religious discourse. When we begin to have even a limited grasp of another language and culture, we have an alternative tool with which we can look at our own country and our own reality and all the assumptions that come with the culture of our birth. 2 months ago, I annoyed someone at a conference in the States by praying for the day in which the White House would be occupied by a black woman who was fluent in English and Spanish. It was not a political prayer. I didn't say she had to be a Democrat. It is my genuine prayer. And I know, because I've been there, that, for example, in the Catholic Archdiocese of Los Angeles, no one would attain the status of bishop did he not speak Spanish. Here, the church gives a lead, and we have to pray that politicians will follow. The third thing which we have to encourage in our American friends and colleagues is not to believe that they rule the world by proxy. I was astounded just a week ago to find in The Guardian this comment about American and British surveillance. James Bamford, a specialist in intelligence, said that every 60 minutes, the US and British intelligence agencies intercept millions of telephone calls, emails, and faxes. But were we to discover who is doing that to us, there would be a conflict. Colin Powell, who many of us have regarded as a hawk, made an outrageous statement recently when he said, "We do not really wish to go to war with people, but by God, we will have the strongest military around, and that's not a bad thing to have. It encourages and champions our friends, and it chills the ambitions of the evil." This kind of rhetoric is what Americans have become inured to, so much so that when a milder version of this presumption crops up in a film like Thunderbirds, nobody notices it. The kind of rhetoric is not unusual. It comes from the mouths of people who believe that by divine right they are the arbiters of world peace and the determiners of world history. It comes from a people who believe, and the roots go right back to the early Puritans in Boston, that they have been specially chosen, that they are the new Israel. This is all documented in the preaching of the 18th century American religious. Have you ever wondered why America has the highest proportion of its male citizens circumcised, though they don't need to be? We hear talk of how the election in November will be to put in place the most powerful man in the world. If this is the case, then the world should have a say as to who the most powerful man will be. Why should a fraction of the American electorate, in a nation which is only 7% of the global population, why should a slim and dubious majority in Florida or who knows where in November put such a person into post? Does Palestine and Peru and Nepal and Haiti and Nigeria not have a say in who will be their terrestrial superior? Of course, the possibility of universal suffrage for the US presidency is but a pipe dream. But if it cannot be a reality, then America has to see itself as one among nations, preferably one among united nations, and avow that there is no country which has a monopoly of political wisdom. And I applaud, this is the hope thing, I applaud people in the States who go out of their way to affirm their connectedness to the rest of the world. Like one man who's a professor of music in, I'll be unspecific because I want him to get into trouble. He's a professor of music in an American university who every year breaks the law by taking his chamber choir via Canada or the Caribbean to Cuba in order that they might sing with Cuban young people, yes, but and also that they might get another perspective on their own land. And I applaud church women from the United Church of Christ in Vermont who this year went to Iran not to do anything other but then to listen to the Iranian people and to try to restore some kind of credibility for their own country. The fourth thing, I suggest that Americans fly the flag less often. I do not know another nation which is so proud, is that the word, or is it defensive of its flag? It flies everywhere. Even before 9/11, it was possible to drive through suburbs of New York and into New England and find people with flagpoles in their lawn and the flag going up in the morning and down at dusk. Last year, I was in Princeton, the university town in New Jersey. I was astounded at the buses, for in the front, they have flashing signs. New Jersey Flyer, Cherry Hill, God Bless America. Now, that in any other country would be regarded as some kind of social paranoia. Can you imagine what it'd be like to go into Islington one Saturday afternoon and see a flagpole with a Union Jack from every second window and the number 73 bus saying, Newington Green, God save the Queen. And I applaud, and this is the hopeful thing, some churches in the state which have removed the stars and stripes from their sanctuaries or have set beside them the national flags of every other person in the congregation. And finally, I want to suggest that God is not used to defend political actions. There is a long biblical pedigree of God failing to be on the side of those who presume God's favour. It's what Jeremiah gets locked up in prison for when he says that the enemy led by Nebuchadnezzar is actually the agent of God and God is bringing judgment on his people. It's what Amos begins his prophecy with when he, from the vantage point of Israel, condemns surrounding nations, much like Reagan looking over the Bay of Mexico. It's what Jesus speaks of when he says, not everyone who calls me Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom of heaven. It's the supreme irony in the parable of the sheep and the goats. For they who call Jesus Lord expect a place at his right hand by dint of their religiosity. And he denies them it because their religion has not been married to works of mercy. Or James, a word to you who are rich and Christian. You have piled up wealth in an age that is near its close. The wages you never paid the men who mowed your fields, who sewed your Nike trainers, who supplied your cheap oil, the wages you never paid are crying loud against you, and the outcry has reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. God is not neutral. And God's partisanship is seen in God's word of judgment against those who use the name of the Most Holy in order to defend exploits, crusades, tirades against others equally made in God's image. And this word is not popular. That is why Oscar Romero died. The day before his assassination, he said to the armed forces who attended Mass in San Salvador, God's command, thou shalt not kill, is higher than any of your military superiors' commands to kill peasants. At least in El Salvador, the military made no pretense of acting under a commander who was obeying the advice of heaven. God has not given a monopoly of spiritual wisdom to the ordained, nor has God given a monopoly of political wisdom to those who in government are proud or quick to use God's name. Christians in any profession get it wrong sometimes. And neither after we get it wrong nor before we embark on something dubious have we any right to invoke God as our supreme advisor unless, like Paul, we allow others to judge the spirit of the message. I have no doubt that what a person believes about humanity, about holiness, about God, shapes as it should shape their political outlook. That's why I'm glad that we are in a country which, because of the witness of the churches, is moving towards the possibility of 0.7% of our gross national product going to the developing world. But humanitarian instincts are different and more open to discussion than alleged private words in our ear from the Almighty. So I urge you as I urge me, particularly if we have an affection for, as I have, as well as a fear of the USA, to encourage its citizens not to feel impotent, but to join in small actions of resistance and reorientation in concert with grassroots activity which is already happening. And I urge you, as I urge me, to pray that God may bless America with wisdom and with courage and with the ability to admit error. And may God bless us with such precious gifts as well. Thank you.